only cheat, making promises they never keep. But I keep looking for what I still haven't found. One honest heart that I can believe in, two loving arms that will never let me go, one good man that I can.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dealer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
George W. likes to live in his own world. In fact, being Bush seems like a joyful, almost dreamlike experience. Reality, for example, never intrudes into his consciousness. And his lies, even his biggest whoppers, seem most sincerely to be believed by him. I have no doubt that he thinks he served in the National Guard, for example. For his second term, George is drawing his world even tighter, moving swiftly to eliminate advisors and officials who might tell him things he doesn't want to hear, further shielding him from bothersome realities in the world. Colin Powell was quickly ushered out the door, even though he had dutifully and unwittingly lied for Bush about those non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Powell was always questioning the blind rush into the war, so George has now plucked this irritant from his administration. Condi Rice, his worshipful national security advisor, has been moved into Powell's chair, and Bush can certainly trust that she won't disturb his consciousness with anything that goes against his neocon ideology. Likewise, his longtime legal lackey, Al Gonzalez, has been dispatched to head the Justice Department, where he can grind out memos to rationalize and legalize any little old thing that strikes George's noggin. Al, you might remember, is the guy who wrote the White House memo saying that torturing Iraqi prisoners was legally okie-dokie. Then there's the CIA, which kept sending intelligence reports to the White House warning that the Iraqi invasion and occupation would have messy consequences. George didn't like to hear that, so now he's put political hack Porter Goss at the CIA helm. Goss is purging top agents who have disagreed with Bush's disastrous policies, warning all CIA employees that their job is to, quote, support the administration and its policies in our work. This is Jim Hightower saying, there. Don't you feel better knowing that George won't be bothered by any unwanted advice or unpleasant reports?
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win at LendingTree.com. Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions apply. See website for details and licensing.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, into cable systems in 29 states with some 30 million families with cable radio network. Archives of White Rose Society. If you want to drop into our chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll take you over to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe, which hosts our chat every day. Our telephone number for the program, 1-866-889-8894. The hot story in the blogosphere right now parallels in some ways the hearings that are going on even as we speak. John Conyers right now is holding hearings in Washington, D.C. Bob Fitrakis of the Free Press, the Columbus Free Presses. I saw him testifying a little earlier. Going to be some interesting testimony coming out of that. We will be reporting on that as time goes on. But there's also this fellow, Clint Curtis. And Clint, I have gotten at least 50 emails in the last 2 days about this Clint Curtis story. You gotta talk about this thing and what's going on. And emails saying, oh, this is it. We found the smoking gun. And then other emails saying, no, look out. This is disinformation or what. So I thought, let's get Clint Curtis on and let's talk about this thing and just lay it out. So Clint Curtis, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you, sir.
I'm pleased to have you on here. Why don't you, just as a beginning point, for those listeners who may be listening to the program at the moment and are not familiar with your story or don't recognize your name, tell us in a snapshot, in a real, short as you can, why you are the hot story in the blogosphere right now.
Don't know about that, but back in 2000, I was working for a company called Yang Enterprises in Oviedo, Florida. And my first introduction to Tom Feeney, who at the time was the Speaker of the House of Florida and their registered lobbyist and their corporate counsel, came in and we had a meeting because I was the technology advisor.
Okay.
And he asked for a program that would be able to alter the votes through a touchscreen system where you couldn't detect it by reading the source code.
In other words, Tom Feeney, who's now a member of the United States House of Representatives, and in the year 2000, as I recall, was head of the Florida House of Representatives, which was the group that said that even if it was demonstrated Al Gore had gotten the most votes, they were still going to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., that Tom Feeney had come to you when you were working with this technology company as the lead technology guy, software guy, mm-hmm. and asked you if you could write software that could be put into voting machines that would cause them to throw elections. Is that an accurate recap?
Correct. I mean, I thought at the time that he was trying to determine what fraud there was rather than trying to create fraud.
Right.
So he sat down and asked for this and gave the specs, and I wrote it. Mrs. Yang told him, sure, we'll go ahead, we'll write the prototype. So I wrote it the next day, handed it to her, said, here it is, and here's a 10-page document on how you would detect the fraud.
Right.
And she said, you don't understand. In order to get the contract, we have to hide the detection of the fraud. This is for controlling the vote in South Florida.
So you were told that the purpose of your writing this vote, this hack or this patch for electronic voting machines that would allow them to throw an election was so that it could be used as some sort of evidence or some sort of, here's a, for example, this is what we should be looking for. Here's the kind of thing we should be looking for if we're going to audit voting machines to prevent vote fraud. And
right.
And then you're told by your boss, after you've produced it, okay, now make it so it's invisible because we're actually going to use it for vote fraud? I mean, was it that overt?
It was that overt. That's exactly what she said.
Okay.
And I told her, not only should you not do that, you cannot do that. As long as they can see the actual source code,
right.
or you give them a receipt, then it's easy to catch.
Right. Now there's, for our listeners who may not be familiar with computer programming, there is source code and there's compiled code. And the source code is that stuff that looks like, you know, line 12, if A equals 12, then B equals 7 or something like that. And then
right.
and then after you have written all of that stuff in BASIC, or you say this was written in Visual BASIC, you know, or whatever language, after you're finished, pardon?
VB5.
Yeah.
Visual Basic 5.
Visual Basic 5, right. After you're finished with that, you run it through a program called a compiler, which converts all this stuff that looks like English language into what looks just like gibberish. I mean, in fact, you can't even really look at it. You try and open it with a word processor, it won't even open. And that is actually the code that's at the machine level. That's the code that the machine uses. And the reason you compile software is to make it much more compact. So this great big bloated program written in BASIC or Visual BASIC or something becomes this fairly small, tight little bit of compiled code. And once code is compiled, it's very difficult, and particularly with things like notations that you put in, comments, references, they just vanish when stuff gets compiled, don't they?
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, so
they don't even get compiled. They're
right,
gone forever.
Right. So you can't decompile code. You can't take compiled code and re-expand it. It's not like opening a zip file, for example, and there's the original. You can't even find the original.
Right.
Once
very
something
difficult.
Has been compiled.
In fact, Microsoft's taken great steps to keep you from being able to do it so that, you know, people can put their programs out there and they don't get stolen.
Right.
So
you
can
don't...
Microsoft decompile it? Possibly. They need to lock the machines down before anything's done, any updates, any patches, because once you patch, whatever was there is no longer there.
Yeah. Now, a couple of questions. Now, here's where the hard questions come. And I know you're on a cell phone and traveling, so it's kind of a noisy signal we have here with you, Clint, but we'll make it work. You're going to be receiving hard questions from both the mainstream media and from people who very much would like to believe that the vote was hacked. And yet, you know, they've got to ask the tough questions because if those things fall apart, if your testimony falls apart, then everybody ends up with egg on their face. And, I mean, there's even a suggestion out there that's been put out, I believe it was, one of the people who's very into the vote manipulation problem. And this was on blackboxvoting.org. I'm not sure if it was Bev Harris who wrote it or not, but it was on their website. And she said, this Feeney vote rigging story sounds like disinformation, and that's dangerous to a clean voting movement, and is concerned that you haven't offered any actual evidence or proof of this beyond your statement. Is there any?
Well, I have put the prototype out there that I wrote so people could analyze it, look at it, make sure, you know, any computer geek out there can play with it and see that it actually works. As far as me being at Yang Enterprises, that can be documented. As far as Feeney being the corporate counsel, that can be documented. Other things that I reported on were they overbilled the state of Florida, and since then DOT has filed, you know, charges or whatever, cases against Yang saying they overbilled the state of Florida, so that can be documented. I reported they were using H-5 for the NASA project. He's since been picked up for trying to send anti-tank missiles to China.
Spying for China?
I have a lot of credibility here.
Yeah, apparently. Now, but at the same time, you're also not, just to be very clear about this and get this on the record, you are not making the suggestion or even the implication that the software that you wrote ever got used to hack the vote anywhere. Is that true?
I would have no idea exactly what he did with it. All I know is that was the intent, and I delivered the product.
To Tom Feeney.
Well, I delivered to Mr. Yang, and she said she's going to give it to Tom Feeney. So.
Okay. So it's kind of one step removed. What is Tom Feeney saying about this, Congressman Tom Feeney of Florida, now?
I don't know. We don't talk much.
I mean, this is a guy. He's on the Judiciary Committee. He's got considerable power. He was Jeb Bush's running mate in 1994 in Florida. This is a big guy to be taking on. I mean, what kind of response are you getting from Congress and from and for that matter, I'm curious if you don't mind talking about it. What kind of response are you getting from the mainstream media?
Everyone seems real open to it so far, and you know, they want to look into it. So far, I haven't had anybody who says, "Oh, who cares?"
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know,
do you think?
I mean, on the very face of it, even if they don't believe it for some reason, although I don't know why they wouldn't, since, you know, I've given them the program, I've given them the spots, you know. But if they don't believe it, on the very face of it, would they put their money in a bank that wouldn't give them a receipt? Because that's what they're doing with their vote.
Yeah, well, and that's something that we've been pointing out for years here, and it's a but that's another issue. I mean, this is really a specific, I won't say charge that you're making, but a smoking gun, let's say there's some smoke that you're pointing to that may indicate that there's a fire, to just keep it at the level of metaphor. Another question that's been asked is, why would you write this thing in Visual Basic when it's going to run on machines that are Unix boxes that don't run Visual Basic?
Well, the box that I wrote it for was a Windows box.
Okay.
So obviously, when it made its way to someplace else, if it made its way to someplace else, it was rewritten in something else. I mean, it's a simple program. It took me 10 minutes to write. Any third grader could write it.
So how did the program work? What exactly did it do?
Well, basically, you have a table, and all the candidates are listed in the table and given an index number. Their index number is associated with what you see on the screen there. I don't know how deep you want to go, but the labels are actually indexed. So you have, like, label 1, index 1, label 1, index 2, label 1, index 3.
Right. So John Kerry becomes candidate 1, George Bush becomes candidate 2, Pat Buchanan becomes candidate 3, and the machine only knows them as 1, 2, and 3.
Only knows them as 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
Doesn't care about anything else. Actually, the code I wrote, it actually recognized the party rather than the person.
I see.
So you could go and hit Republican and switch the vote to Republican, or hit Democrat and switch the vote to Democrat.
So this could be done on on the level of Senate campaign, as we've seen these weird anomalies in North Carolina or the Georgia with Max Cleland's election or diselection.
It could be done one election at a time. You could do the whole board. You could do anything you want to pick.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very simple. And anyway, when you hit the button and you say submit, it counts the vote one at a time. So no matter how much you test it, it will work correctly.
Right.
If you know where the little hot spots are, you hit it, vote flips. And on my program, it actually shows the vote flipping because, you know, you want to tell people you got that.
Right.
On the real box, you wouldn't give that indication.
So
no one standing there, no one watching someone voting would even know it happened.
Right. So, Clint Curtis, the program that you wrote was creating actually invisible buttons on the screen. There were hot spots on the screen that if you knew to touch them
in
the right order, then the computer would react, even though there was no visual graphic thing there that said,
no
here's... Yeah, there's no...
On the screen doesn't mean anything to the computer.
Right.
There's code behind it that takes what you did and say, okay, now you did this, so I think I'll do this with it.
Okay. Very interesting. Clint, we've got to take a break here. We've got some callers who have questions for you, if you don't mind, and I'd like to go just a little deeper on this thing. If you can just stick around for a few minutes.
Sure.
Great. Okay, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire here. No need to sign a loyalty oath to get in. No. The real free speech zone. Stick around. We'll be right back. 20 minutes after the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartman.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17. Call now. 800-505-1546.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And all Iraqi military and civilian personnel should listen carefully to this warning. In any conflict, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Clint Curtis, who says that when he was working with a company in Florida, he and his company were hired by now Congressman Tom Feeney to write a piece of software that would allow an electronic voting machine that produces no paper trail to flip an election. And Clint, I understand that you were a Republican at that time.
Yes.
And
very much so.
Yeah, very much so. What, you know, there's a lot of speculation that the phony documents that were given to Dan Rather about George W. Bush's military service caused an otherwise absolutely factual story to go down in flames because they were forged documents and that they might have been forged by Republican operatives in order to discredit Rather's reporting. How do you respond to those folks who are suspicious that you might be part of a Republican disinformation campaign to make it look like anybody who talks about the dangers of black box voting is somebody who should be wearing a tinfoil hat on their head?
Well, I don't think I come off like that exactly. I would say don't put all your eggs in this story and continue to do what you're doing.
Yeah. Look beyond this, and you're asserting just flat out that you're no longer affiliated with the Republican Party, and this isn't some political dirty trick that you're doing.
No, not affiliated with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Even had a Kerry sticker on my car.
Okay,
can you believe that?
Well,
that
you know, it's getting to where I'll believe anything. This is pretty amazing stuff. Okay, let's take a call here. Dave in Humboldt County, California, on the line. Dave, welcome to the program. You're live with Clint Curtis.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Curtis, I appreciate you coming forward at this time, and I think you are credible. I certainly understand Tom's questions to you because that's been the M.O. of Roe. But I don't have your technical knowledge, so I'll ask this question probably stupidly, but if you got your hands on one of these voting machines using your system, as Bev Harris has been digging up and trying to get them, would you be able to tell, reconstruct what had happened on it at all? Would you be able to know if people went in and voted for the Democrat and the vote came out for a Republican?
In other words, two questions, really. Is there any way to know that a machine actually has your hack or your patch in it, and number one? And number two, if so, is there any way to go back and say, okay, now that we've known this, here's how we can figure out what the real vote actually was before the patch or the hack became active?
Well, if you can get the machines before they are touched again, before any vote goes into them, then somebody much smarter than me, like an IBM or a Microsoft or an MIT, might be able to decompile it. Then I could look at it and tell if mine was there or possibly if someone else's was there once you got down the source code level, depending on the language it's written in.
Right.
DB is kind of my specialty. As far as knowing what the vote is, there's no record. It is gone.
Yeah. So it's toast. I mean, without a paper trail, there's no way to reconstruct. The only thing you can do is hold the election all over again like they're doing in the Ukraine.
Right, because all you have is a total. You don't have who voted for who. And even if you did, you'd flip that at the same time. So it really wouldn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Clint
Curtis, we only have about a minute left in this segment of the program. And have you talked with Congressman John Conyers? He was on our program last week. He's looking into this stuff. Have you got any feedback?
We have handed things off to both the Congress and the Senate to investigate. And who's doing who, I'm not really sure, but
yeah. Okay. And finally, do you see this and just to be clear, you kept a copy of this program and that's what you've put on this website?
No, we were a secure building. Even though we had spies working there, we weren't allowed to take anything off-site.
Okay, so you put something similar to it. You reconstructed it and put it on the website.
It's the same. I mean, you know, it's
yeah.
And
the website is what?
JustToFlyOnTheWall.com. You can download the program. You can download the source code. You have to have DB to see the source code. But.
Right. Okay. www.JustAFlyOnTheWall.com. And that'll do it. Great. Clint Curtis.
I go up on all the blogs so you can get them there, too.
Yeah. Okay, Clint, I know you've got to move along. I appreciate it. Good talking with you. And thank you for being with us today. We will follow this, and we'll see where it goes. Thanks so much. 29 minutes past the hour.
Everyone's favorite thieves are back.
We need a high-paying job.
Yeah, hell yeah. Yeah.
And they're doing a number on Europe.
We need to catch the Americans.
Mr. Ocean is the best.
George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Andy Garcia, Don Cheadle, Bernie Mac, and Julia Roberts.
That is making me a master thief.
Ocean's 12, a Steven Soderbergh film.
I'm freaking out.
Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13 for language, starts December 10th.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dealer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
For death from Kansas on the windswept plains. For death from Miami. For death from Tennessee. For death from the neighborhood of Hollis, Queens.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. A quote for the day from James A. Garfield on July 12, 1880. The former president of the United States said, "Next in importance to freedom and justice is popular education, without which neither freedom nor justice can be permanently maintained." And in that context, in the second hour of our program today, we are going to have our NLP class, Neurolinguistic Programming and Politics. The slogan will be, "What have you done for me lately?" And this is going to be one of my favorite programs, one of my favorite classes in this, because this is stuff that we're going to talk about today that is absolutely applicable to your personal life. to relationships, to business, and to politics, and also to marketing and business. This is one of the great truths that most people just completely miss when thinking about how to position something. So we just had on Clint Curtis, who has made this statement now that a U.S. congressman, a sitting congressman, has hired him to write vote hacking software. And this guy, Clint, is now, he's either going to end up being sued for libel or he's sitting on something. He's sitting on, and time will tell. Time will tell. We're going to see how this story plays out. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Larry in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. As you had that programmer on, I kind of would like to make the point that the Linux operating system is out there and a proven thing, and we could write open source election software that belonged to the county official and was secure because you don't plug it into the wall.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wouldn't even have to be done in Linux. It could still be done in Visual Basic or anything else as long as it was open source. And that's what I've been arguing for a couple of years here on this program. Why is it that we have voting machines that are running software where the voting machine companies refuse to show we, the people, what the software is, what it says, how it works, or what it does? I think it's just wrong, in my opinion. And I absolutely agree with you, Larry. We need to go to open source software, and there are easy and straightforward ways to do it. Brian, and thanks for the call. Brian in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, thanks. I was wondering if all those bumper stickers you see with the yellow ribbons that say support our troops, is that kind of an NLP thing too? Because I support the troops, but isn't that really saying support our policy as opposed to support the troops?
Brian, I'm not really sure. My guess is, and I frankly haven't looked into this, but my guess is that my assumption was that when I saw those ribbons, that I was seeing ribbons that were being distributed somehow by some group to people who were family members of folks who were in Iraq. And I think, I think support our troops is something that we're all behind.
Well, I agree with supporting the troops. I just think that the way that it's phrased kind of, it really means support our policy as opposed to supporting the troops. If you want to support the troops, maybe
bring them home.
Pray for our troops or bring the troops home. Or
yeah.
But support our troops kind of to me just sounds like, hey, support the war, not just the troops. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, good point, Brian, and I don't disagree with you, and maybe somebody will know more about where these things are coming from. I've seen a whole lot of different variations of them. I know, just down the street from us, there's a family who the father is a state policeman, and he's in the guard, and he's been over in Iraq now for 8 months. They got a yellow ribbon on the tree out in front of their house. I mean, this is one of the big problems that's happening all over the country is the fact that we are now undermanned, we've understaffed. We don't have enough National Guard in many states to deal with a real emergency. We don't have our police and fire departments are being wounded by loss of these folks because so many
about
of these
the 57-year-old woman who had been drafted or re-enlisted.
Yeah, well, they had her on TV. I didn't need to talk about it, but there was a 72-year-old woman who went over last week, but she was a volunteer.
Are these signs of a draft coming or what?
No, I don't. There's not a draft coming. And what they're offering $20,000 sign-up bonuses now to Marines, and they're 17% ahead of where they were last year in re-enlistments and enlistments.
Wow.
What they're doing is they're using the fact that their economic policies are devastating the middle class to make it easier for them to get cannon fodder, to get folks to go over to Iraq and be shot at. And it's a tragedy. It's Thomas Jefferson once said, and Brian, thanks for your call, I appreciate it. Thomas Jefferson once said, our nation should, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? We never want to be a nation where our youth find themselves in a situation where they must be willing to be shot at for a shilling. And here we are. Not a shilling, but pretty much the same. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm enjoying the discussion you're having about the voting thing today, and I just wanted to add one thing. I contacted the GAO myself, and I recommend that other people do that as well.
The General Accounting Office.
They have a long history of, I think they're probably one of the few honest parts of our government left. I got no media coverage last year, but they investigate when the AMA was saying there aren't any doctors left in the country because of medical liability, and they investigated, and they came back and basically said, geez, the AMA is lying here because this is what we found. And I found that to be a very interesting part of our government, the Congressional Investigative Utility. And
right.
I would say to everybody, call the GAO and ask them to get involved in this.
But do they? Doesn't the GAO respond to members of Congress rather than to us? I mean, we can't mandate action by the GAO, or am I misinformed?
No, you're absolutely right. But what you can show is public support for this.
I see. Okay. Well, and that sounds like a good plan. Do you have a number for the GAO, or is it just a call 202 information?
It's on the webpage, and I have it someplace, but I'm home today.
Okay.
I think I got the flu here. So
well, that's fine.
I have it at work.
It's probably gao.gov,
It was real
right?
easy to find. You just do gao.gov, and they've got a contact thing for the public, and they actually have a designated person who's fielding this for the voting. So
great.
they actually have somebody whose job it is right now to keep track of how many people are calling them asking for this.
Yeah, well, and we know that these are the folks that John Conyers first handed this ball off to. So, yeah. Okay, well done. Well said, Jeff. Thank you for the call, and thank you for the recommendation. Good information. 1-866-889-8894. Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm just calling to tell you that those little stickers that say support our troops, at least locally, are sold in drugstores.
Interesting. Okay. So
I would think that it's, yes, support our policy, support the, you know.
Yeah. So you think that they are a subtle equivalent of hail to the Fuhrer, or, you know.
Yeah. It's kind of like if I don't have one of those, then I don't support the troops, you know, and if I object to the war, then I don't support the troops. It's kind
yeah.
of part and parcel of that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, thanks for that tip, Lynn. I appreciate it. Learn something new every day. I guess I haven't been in enough drugstores lately. Or maybe they just don't sell them here in Vermont. I'm not sure. I wanted to share with you another part of this incredible disinformation campaign that's going on the part of the conservatives that has the potential to really damage America. There has been some talk in the press in the last few months about the European dream. We used to talk about the American dream in the United States. Everybody wanted the American dream, right? They wanted 2.3 kids and 1.5 cars in the driveway and a three-bedroom home in the suburbs and blah, 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 you know, the American dream, right? And security and good health insurance and a pension plan and a good union job. And the American, and nobody's talking about the American dream anymore. And instead, oddly, a lot of folks are talking about the European dream. Most European countries, people do have job security. They have access to free health care. They actually have retirement plans that actually work. England just recently privatized theirs, and so now the cost of administration has gone from 1% up to 5%. It's causing no end of problems. You got private corporations, you know, fiddling with England's. You know, they've privatized a good chunk of their Social Security, and now it is rife with corruption. But setting aside England, the United Kingdom, the rest of Europe has, you know, very good retirement programs. And they don't, by and large, have involvement between the church and the state. Again, setting aside England, which has an official church-state relationship between the Anglican Church and the royal family. The Queen is the official head of the church. But there is this attempt in the United States to essentially to rewrite history. And I want to share some pieces of this with you. This is Newt Gingrich on Bill O'Reilly's program. It was either yesterday or the day before. And just laying out this, he apparently has a book coming out, and he's starting to pre-hype it. And, we'll get into it as we get into it.
I'd use the word radical instead of progressive. I think it's time to recognize that there's a radical faction in America that hates the idea that we're endowed by our Creator.
Hates. So that's interesting. So let's associate the word progressives with the word hates. Newt is one of the great NLP masters here.
With certain inalienable rights, which is what our Declaration of Independence says.
So they presumably progressives hate the Declaration of Independence in Newt's world. You know, there's this story going around about this guy who they said school would not allow him to teach the Declaration of Independence. Turns out that it was not the case. It had nothing to do with that. He was passing out you know, prayers from the founders and saying, you know, we're teaching American history now. Here's how they all prayed. By the way, please, you know, and it was a thinly veiled attempt to proselytize for Christianity, not to teach history. But nonetheless, the cons have taken this and well, here's the distortion.
They deeply dislike the idea that we are a faith-based country.
Conservatives deeply, well, again, speaking as a Christian, Newt, I'm offended by your saying that, and I don't know of anybody who is offended by faith in the country, but we are not a faith-based country. We are a law-based country. And this is the problem. These guys just make these assertions. The United States is not founded on the Bible. It's founded on the Constitution. We respect the Bible. I personally respect the Bible, but it's the Constitution that is the law of the United States. We are not following the law of Leviticus and taking people who eat shellfish out and stoning them or anybody who mixes cotton and polyester together in their clothing and putting them to death. We are not doing those things, Newt. I'm sorry. Only two of the Ten Commandments are actually laws in the United States. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. The rest of that, you can make graven images all you want. We are a law based nation. But of course, reality and Newt, well.
They think it's judgmental that we actually believe in God.
Judgmental? See, this is called creating the straw man argument. You put out a phony argument about who somebody else is, and then you knock it down.
And therefore, I think their efforts are, frankly, a dagger at the very heart of our spirit and of our nature as a country.
A dagger at the very heart of the spirit and nature of America as a country. And now we get into the real attack on America by Newt
Gingrich. I think it's drifting towards a radical view of the world, which is what's happened to all of Western Europe. Western Europe today is probably the least religious section of the entire planet. The Christian religion is growing very dramatically in Africa. It's growing in Asia. It's growing in Latin America. But in Western Europe, the original heart of Christianity, it has virtually collapsed. And
I can tell you, having lived in Western Europe, it hasn't virtually collapsed. A lot of people go to church in Europe, and it's just that you don't have people trying to legislate religion because they've lived through that in Europe. They remember the Inquisition.
With it has collapsed a whole series of other commitments about the nature of life. And I think the same movement that you were describing in Canada is absolutely the movement that led to the lawsuit last year saying that you shouldn't be allowed to say one nation under God. It's the movement that recently led a California school system to say you should not be allowed to talk about the Declaration of Independence in public school because it references our Creator.
See, there's that disinformation campaign. We had the guy affiliated with that on. And here is the real dagger at the heart of America. He continues.
The answer to judges who don't understand that America was based on the concept of one nation under God, that America was based on the idea that we're endowed by our Creator, frankly, is to close their offices, to do to them what Thomas Jefferson did to the Federalist judges in 1802.
But who? Wait a minute. Thomas Jefferson closed the offices of federal judges in 1802? Even Bill O'Reilly was incredulous.
Can do that. You can't just
The Congress can do that, and the President can do that.
So you want to impeach these judges?
No, you don't have to impeach them. All you have to do is abolish the office. You could take the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, take the five or six wackiest judges out there, decide that they don't understand America, and simply abolish their office.
Who could do that, though, when you say...
The Congress and the President.
Whoa. Well, first of all, let's go back and look at the actual history. I'm sorry, Newt has it wrong. What had happened was you had John Adams who had passed just before in 1798 in the second year of his administration, halfway through his administration, got pushed through the Alien and Sedition Acts that allowed him to throw into jail anybody he disagreed with, which he did, and he did aggressively. And almost all of them were allies of Thomas Jefferson. Most of them were newspaper publishers like Benjamin Franklin Bach, Ben Franklin's grandson, who published the Aurora in Massachusetts, threw him in jail. Along with 20 other newspaper publishers. Many of these newspapers went out of business. They threw into jail Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, who ran for re-election from his jail cell in Vergennes, Vermont, and won, by the way. So the day before John Adams leaves office, John Adams and the Federalist Congress pass a law called the Judiciary Act of 1801. And this creates a whole bunch of new judgeships, and Adams and reduces the number of Supreme Court justices from 6 to 5, which would make it hard. And they were all Federalists at that point. Everybody in the judiciary were good buddies of Adams, all in favor of this aristocracy. And so what Jefferson did when he came in, he couldn't remove these judges. And so in 1802, they repealed the act. Congress repealed the act. And that did away with Adams' midnight appointees. So they just undid a law. They created a law under Adams. They created a whole bunch of new judgeships. And then they uncreated the law just a few months later. That's all. There were two other judges that they considered real problematic, John Pickering and Samuel Chase. And these guys, they both tried to impeach. One of them they succeeded. The guy was clearly an alcoholic and probably mentally ill. The other one they didn't impeach. But it's not at all the way Newt says, and this is Stalinism, in my opinion. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
An international group of scientists say amphibians around the world are in serious trouble. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. People have been talking for years about problems that are hitting frogs and other types of amphibians. A group of 500 scientists recently issued a report on the status of these animals after reviewing research from all corners of the globe. They say the outlook is grim. There are more than 5,700 different species of amphibians, and more than 1,800 of them are headed toward extinction. Simon Stewart directed the project, and he says the results were worse than he ever imagined.
When we started this process to do the global amphibian assessment 3.5 years ago, we never dreamt that the situation would be this bad. Not only is it bad with nearly a third of the species at risk of extinction in the world, but also there are a number of species that are deteriorating very rapidly. 435 species that are in very rapid decline around the world. So, yeah, it's unfortunately a very grim picture.
Stewart is a biologist who works for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. He says amphibians are particularly sensitive creatures. They have permeable skin, so they quickly suffer from exposure to chemicals in their surroundings. And Stewart says many species are adapted to small geographic areas. They can't just pick up and move if their habitat is destroyed or if the climate starts to change. The scientific report is called the Global Amphibian Assessment. A news release about it was issued in October, and Stewart says it drew a lot of attention. He says that's one small piece of good news.
The worldwide coverage of this story has just blown our minds, and the desire that people have to learn more about it suggests that more people care than we might think.
Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller.
You know, everybody likes to make these parallels between Bush and Hitler. I'm starting to, you know, and usually they're overblown, frankly, although there are some. But the parallel that's starting to scare me with folks like Newt Gingrich saying, well, you know, the president has the power to simply do away with judges, which is not true. Not true. And saying, and Jefferson simply did it, which is not true. Go back and read the history. I mean, just, you know, plug into Google the Alien and Sedition Acts and Jefferson. This is it's not a secret. And yet these lies are being promulgated and promoted. And, you know, are we a covenant country or contract country, right? And are we a faith-based country or a law-based country? And they're trying to bring back theocracy. I think that the parallels to Stalin are more realistic, frankly. And that's frankly frightening to me. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Ashland, Kentucky. Hey, Paul, we've only got a couple minutes left here before the show is over, so we've got to do it quick. I also have another call, if that's
okay,
all right with you.
Thanks for taking the call. I don't have a lot of time either.
Okay.
But I just caught the end about you talking about Newt Gingrich and about the little fly, the little ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy those everywhere now. They're,
yeah.
They're just swamped, these quick stops, you know.
Yeah.
But they've sewed a POW in with them.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, you know, I'm all in favor of supporting our troops. I think
I am too.
Wherever they are,
most Democrats I know. Well, every Democrat I know is.
Yeah.
But you was talking about Newt Gingrich. He was talking about God and the Constitution and all this. And that. Isn't that the guy that got caught with one of his aides before he left?
Yeah, Congress? He left Congress because he was porking his his latest girlfriend, and he's the one served the divorce papers on his wife, she was recovering from cancer.
That's like Bill Bennett writing a book on morals.
Yeah, you know? I know. It's you know, welcome to conservative America.
I mean,
it's incredible, Paul. Paul, I got to move along. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. Matt in Memphis, Tennessee. You'll have the last word. We got about 20 seconds. What's up, Matt?
Hey, Tom. I just don't understand why the quote-unquote religious right and the Bush administration doesn't tell the truth about their stance against gay marriage. You know, it's not about morals. It's not about anything like that. It's all about money. It's all about protecting big business and protecting insurance companies, because if gays were allowed to be married, then they'd have to have the same rights with insurance coverage and so forth as everybody else.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. That's an interesting take on it, Matt, and I'm sure that there's a grain of truth to it. I'm more concerned about why they're not telling the truth about their real economic agendas and just the whole thing of, you know, let's turn America back into, or not back into, let's turn it into an aristocracy or a theocracy. It's supposed to be a democracy.
And if we're so anti-abortion, why is it that we're borrowing all this money from communist China? We're going to pay them back with interest, and they promote abortion.
Amen. You got the last word, Matt. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dailer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
You do teach basic ethics to your children, don't you? You know, the difference between right and wrong. For example, I'm sure you teach them that if they get caught violating a family rule, they shouldn't suffer any consequences, but instead should simply be allowed to change that rule to fit their circumstance. Luckily, you can now hold up Tom DeLay as the role model for your children on this ethical twist. DeLay, the Republican majority leader, keeps smashing into our society's rules with his bullying techniques and constant grabs for more political power for himself and his party. Twice this year, he's been brought up on serious ethical violations, but in both cases, he managed to have his behavior reviewed by the toothless, gutless House Ethics Committee, rather than an outside independent investigator. So he got away with what amounts to, "Please don't do that again, Tom." But now, he faces the real possibility of his ethics being judged outside his own little playhouse. A Texas grand jury has already indicted three of his top aides for laundering illegal corporate campaign funds, and DeLay could be next. His legal problems aside, an indictment would cause a big political problem for Tom, since his own party's rules in Congress require that any leader who gets indicted must resign from the leadership post. But old Tom didn't get where he is by playing by anyone's fussy rules. So, in his words, he simply, quote, "fix the rules." As their very first order of business following the November election, the Republican House caucus dutifully acted to shield their leader by scrapping that pesky ethics rule that would have forced DeLay to step down. As a result, even if he is indicted, he'll still be up there as the House Majority Leader, an ethical model for all our nation's children. This is Jim Hightower saying, actually, having an indicted man as the poster boy of the House Republicans might just be a very appropriate symbol.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, the second hour of our... Well, today is the Wednesday show, but we're going to take our Tuesday cue here today. Today, the 8th of December, and do what is it now, our fourth, I think, lesson in neurolinguistic programming. We're going to talk about this stuff for maybe 15, 20 minutes. We're going to take a break from it at 25 minutes after the hour. We'll be hearing from the Talk Radio News Service with a report from Washington, D.C., and no doubt an update on how the hearings are going. Yeah, before Congress, before John Conyers' committee, before Congress about the voting problems in Florida and elsewhere. And we'll get that report at 25 after. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll come back to this a little bit. And then we'll get back into the rest of the news for the day. So that's our hour for this hour. And in the next hour, is America really divided? We've got a fascinating guest who's going to be on in the next hour suggesting that this whole thing about red states and blue states is a bunch of hooey. Let you make up your own mind on that. A Los Angeles Times exit poll, an LA Times exit poll right after the election, asked voters what most influenced their choice when they voted. 24% said the person that they voted for because he shared their values for president. But 55% said that the person that they voted for, this is John Kerry and George W. Bush, and Bednarik and David Cobb, and, you know, right across the board, 55% said that they voted for the person they perceived as the strong leader. Now, had the media gotten a hold of that poll before they got a hold of the poll that said that 20-some-odd percent, 22% of people said that they chose moral values, 20% choose the economy or jobs, 90% chose terrorism. We would not be having discussions right now about whether, you know, Falwell wouldn't be being featured on TV shows, whether, you know, morality was an issue in America. Instead, we'd be having a discussion about why was it that, or how was it that George W. Bush portrayed himself as a strong leader when, in fact, you know, 9/11 happened on his watch. He screwed up the war in Iraq, you know, things like that. His attempts at leadership have, by and large, all failed. And why didn't John Kerry more effectively communicate that he was a strong leader to flip at least 70,000 votes in the state of Ohio, assuming that they weren't flipped by a machine? We would be having a different discussion. What this highlights is the power of framing, which we talked about last week or the week before. And I just want to bring back that for just a second, just to touch on that, and then take it a step further. Let's dig a layer deeper into this stuff. Let's both chunk up and chunk down. Let's look at a little more detail, and yet get a good grip here on a larger story. The predicate, the neurolinguistic programming predicate that we're going to talk about today, the assumption, is that the meaning of communication is the response you get. People say, what does that mean? Well, if you said, what does that mean, then what I just communicated was confusion. In other words, you may say something to somebody and think you're saying ABC, but they respond to you as if you said XYZ. What was communicated? The reality is that what was communicated was XYZ, because that's what they thought they heard. Are you getting this? So the meaning of the communication is not what you say or what you think or what you have in mind or what you intend. It's what the other person gets. Now, this is true in politics. It's true in debate. It's true in business. It's true in our personal lives. And I'm going to start out with the personal example of this, so that you get it, so you can see how it works, you get the story of it, you can grab hold of it. And then we're going to expand that out into how politicians can use this, how a political party can use this, and how you and I can use this in having conversations with people about anything from politics to religion, anything else you want to discuss with somebody, where you want to have good, clean, open, honest, straightforward communication that actually works, because that is really what neurolinguistic programming is all about. It really is all about truly effective communication. And here's the bottom line. We never know what another person is feeling or experiencing or thinking. We never know. We can only make guesses based on our observation of their behavior. I've been married to Louise for, 32 years? I'll never know for sure if she really loves me, for example. I can observe her behavior and make an assumption, and it's probably accurate, but I can't get inside her head. Nobody can. We're not telepaths. In fact, the only system that we have to actually get inside the mind of another person is called the novel, fiction, which is why fiction endures. It's why novels are so popular, why people are still reading. Can't do it with movies, can't do it with TV, because there you're having to observe people's behavior. And you can't do it in real life. You can only do it in the novel, to actually get inside somebody else's head. So because we can't get inside somebody else's head, we have to guess as to the meaning of their behaviors. Similarly, other people are guessing as to the meaning of our behaviors. So if we want to be effective communicators, we want to make sure that our behavior communicates what we intend for it to communicate, right? This all sounds pretty straightforward. But it's going to get complicated in a minute, in a way that is, you're going to get one of these incredible ahas. But just to understand, this is the basis of social interactions and relationships. It's the quality of our ability to guess correctly. It will always have impact on the quality of our relationships. So, of course, we want to improve that. You want to improve your guessing ability. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to simply ask questions. Did I just hear you say ABC? Did you mean to say ABC? Is that what you were really talking about? Because, again, to make this a personal example just for a minute, the reality is that you'll never know if somebody loves you. You'll just know if they behave like they do, which gives you the feeling and ultimately the certainty over time that they do. But what if somebody really does love you, but you don't feel it or know it? Or what if you love somebody and they don't know it or feel it? And to take this into the political realm, what if a politician has the very best and most honest intentions and goals totally congruent with the voters, but the voters don't know it or believe it? How can that politician get that message across? First, let's look at the personal dimension of this. I just tell you a story. Louise and I took this class in NLP from a fellow by the name of Life Roland, who runs the NLP Center of Atlanta. This was back 15 years ago, maybe thereabouts. And Life was a student of Christina Hall, who was a student of Richard Bandler, who, after taking Life's course, I took a NLP trainer's training from Richard Bandler, and Richard wrote the foreword to my book, Healing ADD, which is a book about neurolinguistic programming. And so anyhow, we're in this class, and it was like one of these kind of six-month things where every weekend, you know, you'd hang out with these folks. And we're in this class. And Life, the instructor, he's Danish, as I recall, Life turns to me and says, Tom, how do you know when to know that you know that Louise really loves you? How do you know when to know? In other words, what's the trigger? What's the thing that happens that says, oh, now I know? How do you know when to know that you know that gives me some certainty that Louise really loves me? And I said, oh, that's really easy. And I'm telling the story, by the way, with her permission. I said, that's really easy. It's when she touches me. Now you can psychoanalyze that to death. Is it because, you know, his mother carried him around a lot when he was a baby or didn't enough? Frankly, I would argue toward the former. My mother was a very affectionate and still is a very affectionate person. But is it how my DNA is wired, or is it the first girlfriend that I had was like that? I don't have any idea. It doesn't matter. This is where analysis breaks down, in my opinion, and so much of psychology breaks down. The reality is that when somebody touches me, I feel like I'm loved. Total stranger walked up, put their hand on my arm, and it would cause me to immediately feel a little better. And when Louise touches me or hugs me or kisses me or something like that, I feel, hey, I know for sure that she loves me. So then he turns to Louise. And he says to Louise, Louise, how do you know when to know that you know that Tom loves you? And I'm sitting there waiting for her to say, oh, when he hugs me, kisses me, touches me. Because that's how I know that I'm loved, right? And she says, when we have coffee together in the morning and talk about the day and talk about the things that are really important to us. And I'm sitting there going, what? I've been trying to get out of this for 15 years, this coffee in the morning thing. I never understood it. What's the big deal? And she's saying that this is how she knows that I love her. And I said, but what about when I touch you? What about when I kiss you? You know, stuff. She says, well, that's all fine, but, you know, I really know that you love me when you have coffee with me in the morning. We talk about the day. And it was one of those epiphanous moments when I suddenly realized that the way I experience the world is not the way other people, specifically my wife, experience the world. And two really interesting things came out of this. And again, this is the personal story side of it. We'll generalize this to politics after the break at the bottom of the hour and get into how politicians can do this and what the ways are that you can use this in a political context. But the two things that came out of this, number one, Louise and I made a deal. She'll touch me more. I'll have breakfast. I'll have coffee with her every morning, and we'll talk. And it was one of the most powerful and positive things that has happened in all the 30-plus years that we've been married. And we still do it. We did it this morning. So that seemed like a pretty good deal. The other thing was we sat down with our three kids. And all three of our kids were living at home at the time. They're all grown up and moved away now. And we said, how do you know that we love you? What is it that we do that makes you feel loved? And it was just amazing. One of our kids said, when you tell me you love me. Another one of our kids said, when you teach me things. This was the one of our children that had demanded that we homeschool her, and we did. And she still to this day, she will call with questions about science and things. That's how she knows she's loved, when we teach her things. And the third one, we said, you know, how do you know that you're loved? And he said, when you take me out to breakfast alone. And I had been resisting that all through his childhood. I thought he was playing some kind of, you know, funny mind game, sibling rivalry with his sisters. No, that's how he knows that he's loved. And so now he comes to visit. I say, hey, let's go to breakfast. Boom, he's out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning. Even if he was out until 3 in the morning at the local bar. Once you know how people, you know, what makes people feel good, then you can do it for them. Isn't that a cool idea? Well, let's take that to politics after the break. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
Everyone's favorite thieves are back.
We need a high-paying job.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And they're doing a number on Europe.
We need to catch the Americans.
Mr. Ocean is the best.
George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Andy Garcia, Don Cheadle, Bernie Mac, and Julia Roberts.
That is making me a master thief.
Ocean's 12, a Steven Soderbergh film.
I'm freaking out.
Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13 for language. Now playing.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palisex books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. See, that's the challenge. That's what we've been talking about. How can you get inside another person's head? You can't. You can only observe it from the outside. Just a quick note, Rob Call from opednews.com was motivated to call in. He wanted to share something with. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to remind you and your listeners that you will be giving workshops on NLP at the conferences that I run in February in Palm Springs, February 5th and 6th. You'll be doing workshops there on the Winter Brain Conference, the StoryCon conference, and the Optimal Functioning and Positive Psychology meeting that all run simultaneously. And people can find out about it at www.brainmeeting.com. Brainmeeting.com.
Great.
You've been to those meetings. What do you think of them, Tom?
Thanks for the shameless plug, Rob. I love those meetings. I've said before, and you can quote me, the Winter Brain Conference, which I've been speaking at for, 8 years now, something like that?
It's going to be 10.
10 years. Is the only, and I speak at conferences from neurology conferences to psychology conferences to education conferences. I keynoted the Montessori conference the year before last. I mean, I do a lot of that stuff. I did a lot more before we started doing this radio show, but I still do some of it. And your conference is the only conference that I would pay to attend. I'm very fortunate that because I speak, I don't have to pay to attend, but it's the only one of all the conferences where people bring me in to speak where I would actually show up even if I wasn't a speaker. I'm very grateful for what you're doing, Rob. You do great work. So thanks for that. And the website again was
brainmeeting.com, www.brainmeeting.com.
Brainmeeting.com. Thanks a lot, Rob. That's Rob Call of opednews.com, another great website as well. Rob, thanks for the call. Let's go to Victoria Jones for our daily report from the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
Are you at those hearings that John Conyers is holding?
No, as a matter of fact, I just stepped out of the White House press briefing with Scott McClellan because he doesn't like it if you make phone calls to even to you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that upstarts Scott McClellan. My goodness.
I know. So I'm standing outside right now.
Yeah.
I've been on White House patrol this morning.
And what's happening at the White House?
Well, McClellan says that the president is very pleased that the intelligence bill has gone through the House. That it seems to be going through the Senate. He looks forward to receiving it. He thinks it's unlikely that it will be signed this week because they need to work out schedules with the members of Congress who probably want to be there for the signing. Talked about that. Also, some questions were asked about baseball and why the president hasn't got personally involved in the talks. No real clear answer on that one. Apparently, he has a friend who's a sort of an intermediary, but when he was pressed on this, he went on to say how the president's spoken out many times about this issue, but didn't speak about why the president hasn't become involved. Also, the question of whether about 1 million or so Iranians have gone into Iraq to try and vote or are going into Iraq to try and vote in the elections and to disrupt things.
Whoa.
He was asked repeatedly about this.
Yeah.
And about what the U.S. intends to do if that happens. And he repeated several times that the Iranians have been a signatory to a particular memo about this or on this issue generally, and we expect them to abide by that, but he would not address, and he was pushed very specifically on this, well, if they do this, what's our plan?
Yeah.
And he would not say.
Our plan is to let whoever gets elected get elected and say, good luck, buddy, we're out of here. And get out before the next presidential election. That's our plan, and that's and whatever it takes. And we have a long history of supporting dictators and strongmen. We put Saddam Hussein himself into power and supported him right up until 1991. We sold him the weapons he used against his own people. And there's no doubt in my mind that we will do it again. if necessary. It's in the national interest, you could argue. So, but that's anyhow. We'll see. You got to check out the hearings that John Conyers is holding. By the way, Victoria, they're on C-SPAN right now, and they're just absolutely wild. These people from Ohio, disenfranchised voters, really upset. So
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So check that out. Thanks for the report from Washington D.C. I do appreciate it. Great to hear from you, Victoria. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. We'll be back with our NLP lesson, our neuro-linguistic programming lesson for the day. Right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live? And who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do. Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dealer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
See, that's the key, figuring out what is it that makes somebody else happy. I remember back in, must have been like 1980 or something, Remember Est, Warner Earhart, and all that general craziness? And there was this slogan that came out of Est that really summarized this very, very well. And it was something to the effect of, I'll never know or I don't care if you really love me. Just keep bringing the flowers. And because the reality is, as I mentioned in the first half hour of this particular hour of our show, our NLP lesson for the day, for the week, that we can never know what's actually going on inside another person's mind or heart. We can only observe from the outside and make guesses based on what we're observing. And therefore, what has to be is that the meaning of a communication is not what you say. It's the response you get from the other person. You know, it takes two to tango and all that. Well, it takes two to communicate. And if you want to know what it is you actually communicated, ask the other person. And, you know, they will tell you. So, excuse me. So, how do politicians do this? This is a big challenge for a politician. How do you know that the people really know that you really care about them if you're a politician? How does a political party make use of this? Make use of this fact that it's not your intent that matters. It's not even how you communicate your intent that matters. It's whether or not people on the receiving end of the communication get your intent that matters. So here's a couple of ways to make this more practical in the context of politics. Number one, communicate in their language. That is, in the language of the person who's going to receive it. Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago about visual, auditory, kinesthetic people, stuff like that. Of course, you want your message to be multimodal. You want to talk in terms of pictures. You want to talk in terms of stories. You want to talk in terms of feelings. You want to do all those things, of course. But even more important in the context of talking in someone else's language, in the language of the person who's receiving the message, is this old marketing notion of benefits versus features. I used to teach this stuff for a living back in the ad agency days. And here's this is the key to it. This is how it works. This is one of the big pieces. There are benefits and there are features and they are different. And most people, when they're trying to communicate something, don't understand the difference between these two, and they go really heavy on one or the other, and therefore their communication fails, particularly in mass communication, particularly in political communication, although also in commerce. But this is even true in relationships. But we've already discussed relationships to some extent with this regard. But here's what the difference is between a benefit and a feature. A benefit answers the question, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? If you can answer that question, that's a benefit. Oh, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to feel better. I'm going to smile more. I'm going to have safety in my old age. That's a benefit. If it answers the question, what's in it for me, it's a benefit. If it answers the question, how does that work? Then it's a feature. How are you going to do that? That's a feature. Well, we're going to take the cap on Social Security. Right now, nobody has to pay Social Security taxes, FICA taxes, on anything over the first $87,000 that they pay or that they earn. And we're going to just raise that cap from $87,000 to $150,000 or to $1 million or to $1 billion. We're going to eliminate the cap so even millionaires are still paying into the Social Security Trust Fund. And therefore, we are going to make Social Security solvent for all of history, all into the future. And that's really all it would take. Well, that's a feature, right? That explains how it works. And here's the amazing thing. You got a lot of wonks, you know, like Al Gore. Let's put Social Security in a lockbox. That's a feature. It's a how we're going to do it. And he didn't connect it to a benefit. Here's the bottom line. Benefits without features are never believed. In other words, if I say to you, I'm going to make sure you're safe in your old age, and then just stop there and don't tell you how, you're not going to believe it. Benefits without features have no credibility. features without benefits have no relevance. They elicit the response, so what? Right. If I say, we're going to eliminate the cap on FICA. So even millionaires and billionaires are paying Social Security taxes on their income. You say, so? What does that have to do with me? So features without benefits lack relevance. Benefits without features lack credibility. Any effective communication must have both relevance and credibility. It must answer the question, what's in it for me? And it must answer the question, and how are you going to do that? And it must do it all at the same time. And I'm telling you, the cons have been masters at this kind of packaging, going all the way back to when Newt Gingrich first started using NLP in his contract with America. And Frank Luntz, these guys, Gingrich and Luntz are the masters of this stuff. Of packaging things in a way that said, you know, we are going to make life better, and here's how. And the "and here's how" does not have to be incredibly detailed. It can be, and here's the 10 steps we call it the Contract with America, and here's these laws that we want to pass. And you go through the Contract with America, you discover that about 6 of the 10 points, as I recall, all boiled down to tax cuts for the rich. But it didn't matter. Because there appeared to be, in fact, there was this belief that if you gave tax cuts to the rich, that it would make America more prosperous. Turns out not to have worked that way, as, you know, rational economists have been pointing out for quite some time now. But in any case, you must have both features and benefits. So whenever you're talking about anything, where you're trying to convince somebody of something, ask yourself the question, from their point of view, how can I make this relevant to them? How can I, from their point of view, how can I bring this into the realm of, oh, that's what this means to me? For example, one of the issues that we talk about on this program from time to time is this conflation of church and state, the merging of church and state that is so beloved, the idea of it so beloved by so many so-called conservatives. In my opinion, the danger that this represents is not so much in that the church would take over the state. Because, frankly, I think that, you know, halfway into the new Inquisition, you'd have so much blowback from Americans that it would stop. The danger, and you're already seeing it, I mean, these just little tiny incursions where church groups are trying to, you know, they're putting stickers in books that say, you know, evolution is just a theory, and they're already getting blowback. I'm not, frankly, so worried about churches taking over state in the United States. I know, yeah, they're trying. They've been trying for 200 years. But I'm not real worried about it. My concern, and this, oddly or ironically or whatever, this was the main concern of James Madison. My concern, and the founder's concern, is that if churches and state get into bed together, it's going to corrupt the church. That the churches will be corrupted by that access to power and wealth. And they will lose track of their mission, which I think probably most people would agree is to provide solace or salvation or help or, you know, however you want to define it, to people. So if I'm talking to somebody and they're saying, you know, we need to have more church in state, I would be wanting to say, you know, the question, you ask the question, how can I make this relevant to them? I'd say, you know, do you attend a church? Are you involved in a religion? Are you a believer in a religion? Aren't you concerned? And presumably they say yes. And you say, well, aren't you concerned that if your religion ends up getting these laws passed that it wants to have passed, that one of two things might happen. Number one, that your religious leaders might get so in love with political power that they lose track of their religion, that they lose that they're no longer, that they're now, you know, popes, they're now theocrats. And that's the weaker argument. You know, thinking people will go, yeah, that's a legitimate concern, but many people won't. And you say, or aren't you concerned that if your religion can get laws passed, other religions can get laws passed, and what happens when the Moonies decide to get into the act? You know, Reverend Moon owns the Washington Times. He owns United Press International. He makes huge contributions to the Republican Party. He's one of the largest financial patrons to both George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. And he has claimed that he is the Messiah, that he is the Messiah. Forget about Jesus coming back to the earth. Reverend Moon is the Messiah. He's already here. Aren't you a little concerned if churches start running the state with what's going to happen when another church, not yours, gets in there? Or the church of the Wiccans, or the church of the church of the Gooey Death God Stamp Redemption Center. Fill in the blank. So make it relevant. Features and benefits. Number two, show, don't tell. Again, this is back to this issue of how politicians. This is one uniquely for politicians. Here's my advice to John Kerry, Howard Dean, on the list goes. Show, don't tell. We want to know that what you're talking about doing is something that you're actually doing. Here's this, for example, here's this news story, today's Associated Press, article by Mark Humbert. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, whose white-collar crime investigations have sent a shudder through Wall Street, announced Tuesday he is running for governor in 2006. Now, I mean, you know, Republicans for a long, long time have been saying, you know, this guy, he's the Attorney General, he's also known as AG. They've been making jokes forever that AG stands for aspiring governor, right? And they've been cynically saying, well, Elliot Spitzer is only going after these corporate fat cats and corporate corruption and corporate crime because he wants to get publicity because he wants to run for governor. Same way people were saying that Rudy Giuliani, when he was the prosecutor for New York City, was going after the head prosecutor, whatever you call it, prosecuting attorney for New York City, was going after the head shops and was going after the sex stores and all this stuff and was, you know, cracking down on crime in New York City back in the 80s. And he really was. He was really rip-roaring going to town. And he's just doing that because he wants to run for mayor. Of course, that's what the cynics say. And there may be some truth to it. But the reality is that what these guys are doing, what Giuliani, the Republican, did as prosecutor, and what Spitzer, the Attorney General, is doing right now, both of them aspiring to higher office, what they're doing is they are showing voters what they're all about and what the voters can expect them to be about and expect them to be doing if and when they become elected into the next office up. And, you know, I think that, you know, one of the criticisms of John Kerry that was made by the Republicans that stuck a little more than a lot, frankly, I think, was that he didn't have legislative signature accomplishments for his 20 years in the legislature. Now, we know that he did some marvelous things. His BCCI investigation was absolutely mind-boggling. And you go back and look at that. This guy, as a prosecuting attorney or as a prosecutor and investigator, John Kerry is one of the finest in history. And in the Senate, he played that role brilliantly. But the Republicans came along and said, but there's not really, you know, this long legislative history that shows what he would do if he was president. He hasn't initiated great things. I mean, if Newt Gingrich was running for president, if he hadn't gotten caught with his second wife with his third girlfriend, not metaphorically, he might have. I mean, who knows? But if Newt was running for president, you'd know what he was about because he tried to do those things when he was in the legislature. So here's the advice to politicians. Don't just talk about it. Start doing it. Even at the smallest level, even at a local level, whatever it may be, don't be afraid of those people who say, oh, he's just grandstanding. Okay, number three, ask for feedback. This is really important for politicians and for anybody who wants to argue about politics. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders, one of the most progressive members of Congress, consistently wins the most conservative rural districts in the state of Vermont year after year after year. Why? Because he does, 50, 60 town meetings every single year in this state. Every week he's in a different town having a town meeting, and he's asking for feedback. Pat Leahy, 6 years ago, went around the state with Fred Tuttle, who was his Republican opponent, and they had cookies and coffee with Pat and Fred in every little coffee shop in the state. Ask for feedback. And finally, campaign 365 days a year. Be out there, be active, and call for action. You do those things, you will win politically. 10 minutes before the hour.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a WIN feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. A strike of some 500 Santa Cruz, California City employees was sidestepped for the time being last Thursday when representatives from SEIU Local 415 and city officials came to terms on a tentative agreement in their contract dispute. WIN reporter Vinnie Lombardo has the details.
For City Hall groundskeepers, it was business as usual Thursday, with their contract set to expire in a day's time. While the city of Santa Cruz employs over 800 people, only about 500 workers threatened to strike. Police and firefighters are on a separate contract. According to Leslie Scanagata, chief spokesperson for SEIU Local 415, rising health care costs and low wages are the key issues on the bargaining table.
They have actually, they're receiving less take-home pay now than they were 2 years ago.
Scanagata points out that Local 415 members have twice agreed to a voluntary wage freeze to help the city get through a financial crunch and haven't had a raise since April 2002. In January, city workers are expected to absorb a 3.2% cost increase in health benefits. Santa Cruz Mayor Mike Rotkin agrees workers deserve a decent package, but with city coffers running dry, the council had no proposals for the union.
The city council, looking at our situation about a month ago, really felt like we didn't have any way to get the money. We didn't know where to get it.
A breakthrough came Thursday when the city was able to secure a one-time state grant to cover the workers' pay raise for 1 year.
That means that they will get some pay increase this year, but then next year bets will be off and we'll be back to bargaining with a difficult situation again.
Meantime, both the mayor and Local 415 reps are hopeful the workers accept the deal being offered.
There's a general membership meeting that members only, they attend, and they will be voting throughout next week until Wednesday evening, and when we'll count the ballots and we'll know whether they accept it or reject it.
With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Vinny Lombardo in Santa Cruz, California.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Who by powder, who for his greed, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling?
And so to wrap up our NLP lesson for the week here in the second hour of our program, our normal Tuesday segment here being held on Wednesday, and another week when, which day of the week is it today? We sort of planned it this way. Anyway, to wrap this up, number one, always try, when you're talking with other people about politics, always try to use simple frames, straightforward, easy to understand terms or phrases, a simple framework to encapsulate your information, and be sure that that frame includes a benefit, that it explicitly, not implicitly, not sort of implies it, but it explicitly, that it says right straight out, here's how this is going to help you. This is why you should care about this. It's not just an abstract principle. Here's where the rubber meets the road. Number one, talk in terms of benefits and always use a simple frame. Number two, find areas of common values to start from in a discussion and frame in the context of those. You've heard me when I've had conservatives on this program. I'll start out very often by saying, you know, I'm sure that you and I both want a strong country. We both love our country. We both want our children to grow up in a nation where they will have the opportunities that we had as young people. We want them to be as safe as we were, and in fact, even safer. Now, let's talk about the areas where we disagree about how to accomplish those goals. As soon as you start from that point, from the commonality, it becomes, the discussion becomes one of problem solving, perhaps by different means, rather than arguing. Because when people perceive something as just an argument, they dig their heels in. Again, the meaning of a communication is the response you get. And if somebody's digging in their heels, what they're hearing from you is not benefit or even feature. What they're hearing from you is something that they're imagining to be a negative. Oh, he must be a liberal, or he must be weak on defense, or whatever, right? So they're hearing something that you're not actually intending to communicate. So be explicit. Number three, ask for feedback. Don't assume you're getting the response you're getting. Politicians need to be talking to the people constantly. We need to be talking to each other. Ask people, can you tell me what I just told you? Explain it to me in a way or in another way. Do you see any other applications so that you get some sense of that they got what you're talking about? And number four, always call for action. Always end with a, and therefore we should. and therefore we must get politically involved. Amen.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dealer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
What is it about ultra-right conservatives who bill careers as tongue-clucking scolds? They constantly preach about the moral failings of the rest of us, yet they keep getting caught with their own pants down, morally speaking. I don't merely mean the Falwells, Swaggerts, and other publicly compromised televangelists, but also the right-wing politicos who prance about so piously on their moral high horses. For example, how swell to be lectured on family values by Newt Gingrich, who's now on his third marriage, or is it number four? Also, how perfect to have Bill Bennett anoint himself as the nation's arbiter of conservative virtues, while he sneaks around feeding his gambling addiction. And who can forget the bombastic moral authority of the airwaves, Rush Limbaugh, using his housekeeper to score illegal drugs for him, then trying to lie about it? Are these people born with an extra hypocrisy gene? It's not just in America, either. Britain is all a-twitter these days about one of its own especially noisy tongue-cluckers, the Right Honorable Boris Johnson. He's the Latin-spouting, Eton-schooled editor of the right-wing Spectator, a London newspaper long tied to England's plutocratic Conservative Party. Indeed, Boris himself is a Conservative Party member of the Parliament, where he has served as the party's official spokesperson on cultural policies, freely criticizing the personal morality of others. He's now been removed from that party post, however, since it has been revealed that Boris the Moralist, who is married and has four children, has been cheating on his wife, having an affair with a society columnist at his paper. Furthermore, Boris impregnated the mistress, she had an abortion, and he tried to lie about it, initially calling the accusations an inverted pyramid of piffle. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a great phrase! Right-wingers lecturing us on morality are dumping a pyramid of political piffle on us.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricetin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricetin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricetin HBP. Use as directed.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from the Sirius satellite radio system, deep in outer space, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. And on cable systems in 29 states on cable radio network. Is America a divided nation? Are we red states and blue states? If I, as a citizen of the People's Republic of Vermont, walk into the state of, for example, Ohio, does that mean that I'm the enemy? Am I perceived as such? Is there this divide that has so much has been made of in the press? Samuel Abrams isn't quite so sure, and he's the co-author of a book called Culture War, The Myth of a Polarized America, research fellow at the Center for Basic Research in the Social Sciences at Harvard University, and a research associate at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Mr. Abrams, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
Or should I call you Dr. Abrams?
Mr. Abrams is great.
Okay, or Samuel.
Sam is perfect.
Whatever you wish.
Thank you.
Okay, great. A couple of quick questions here. First of all, you suggest that the political class has distorted the reality of most Americans' actual views about the political class being kind of the professional politicians and the spinmeisters about social, political, and economic issues for over 30 years now. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Sure. It means that when we spend years and years looking at people, asking them questions, giving them a chance to really think long and hard about issues that appear divisive to many, what we were able to uncover very simply is that America is not divided. 80 to 90% of Americans are very thoughtful, are very even-handed, and are very centrist. They're not radicals, they're not left, they're not right, they're really in the middle. Unfortunately, they're not well-coordinated, and they tend not to vote in as high numbers as the people on the extremes. The elites, as you had mentioned, this involves the political class. These are the very strong partisans, the people that protest, the people that organize, the people that donate large amounts of money, the people that go out and have petitions signed, coupled with a media that's incredibly hungry, a media that works on a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week news cycle that's desperate to find news. So the media covers these people on the extremes, and you know, it's very visceral. There's a lot that seems very, very charged, and you can find people on either side of the extreme, on both the left and the right. What tends to happen, therefore, is the media is hungry. They're looking for extremes. You have a very small minority, but a very, very well-coordinated minority that makes a lot of noise. And together, these two elements make it appear as if we're very divided. When in reality, 80 to 90% of Americans are simply not.
Now, what I find fascinating about this, Sam Abrams, is that the In the period, for example, leading up to the war in Iraq, certainly the "let's go to war" bunch were well represented. I mean, they were very, very well represented, and the networks had their graphics departments working overtime, and it was just this, you know, with these little, you know, zoom in action figures and showing how bombs are going to be dropped and all this, you know, all this stuff and the whole shock and awe thing. And it was being super hyped. But you go back and you look at the statistics, and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has done a really good job of pulling this together on their website. And I think MediaMatters.org also has this information. You find that the anti-war position, which was actually held by more than 50% of Americans, was represented about 3% versus 97% pro-war on most network and cable television. And we had Jeff Cohen on here the other day, who produced the Phil Donahue show and who had his own show on MSNBC, and he said that the official policy, which came down from General Electric, the official MSNBC policy is that if you have a liberal on, you must have at least two conservatives on, and if you have a strong liberal on, like Michael Moore or Amy Goodman, you must have three conservatives on at the same time. Mm-hmm. How is that?
In terms of polarizing effects, it really creates a sense of polarization, quite frankly.
But isn't it kind of unipolar?
I'm sorry, say that again?
I guess my question is it polar or is it unipolar? No,
I believe it's very, very polar. And the reason for that is take a look at some of the formats on these shows. Take a look at Scarborough Country. Take a look at Chris Matthews' work. Take a look at Fox, which tends to be a more conservative counterpart to MSNBC, for instance. And while they may attempt to present fair and balanced ideas, they tend not to be, first of all. But more importantly, what happens is these are very, very visceral issues. You're not getting long and, you know, detailed discussions of tax policy, issues that really affect people, such as the economy. Everyone agrees that we need a tax cut to a degree. Everyone believes that we need more jobs. There are questions, of course, about how to go about doing that, but, you know, no one's going to tune in if you're having a fair and very even-handed discussion. If you're going to find people who are sharp and going at one another on these news shows, even if it's balanced, it's only going to continue to polarize people. Information, new information, is not necessarily being introduced to the minds of the electorate, and the people who tend to watch these shows in particular tend to already have their minds made up. So shows of this sort tend to push, this is a wonderful filtering effect we see, tend to really reinforce preconceived ideas, dispositions individuals had toward a particular viewpoint. And these shows certainly
in the
are
extreme.
Not constructive to eliminating polarization, even though, again, they may certainly look like it, because sure, they'll say we'll bring a Republican and a Democrat, a strong liberal, a strong conservative, and so on, but the discussion, the nature of the discourse is rarely civil, often involves shouting. The host tends to spin it, and again, it's not productive, and it again creates dissent.
So what we have is the Worldwide Wrestling Federation style of entertainment has become has come to our political discourse. The goal of good, what is perceived as good, or at least profitable from a network point of view, political programming, is programming that slaps down, that entertains, that, you know, where people are being thrown over the ropes to the audience who are yelling and hooting and throwing chairs, metaphorically.
Absolutely. And yeah. Your show is a perfect example of what's not what's going on that's right. For instance, I'm on for well over 3 to 4 minutes already of talk time. I'm actually able to present my viewpoint. I'm not yelling. You're not yelling back at me. On a number of shows that I've appeared on, for instance, they're very quick to point out they want a soundbite. I will give them a soundbite. I'll try to make more of a case. And very quickly, I'm shut down. My mic is cut off. And another person who disagrees with me will start to shout and say, for instance, well, I'm nuts. There is a culture war. You have to understand the battle for the soul of America rages, for instance.
Yeah.
And I'll say, well, no, it doesn't. Unfortunately, that doesn't contribute, and I've stopped doing it because I, quite frankly, then became part of the problem.
Yeah.
And that is part of the problem.
Well, but there's, you know, Sam Abrams, there is an interesting dynamic at work here, because I can tell you, I mean, I do this for a living. Here I am, a talk show host. I've been doing this program for 2 years, what is called in the media, I suppose, liberal talk radio. And one of the things that we regularly do, that I regularly do, is I have conservatives on to argue with me. And where I do it probably a little differently from the Hannitys of the world is I'll actually let them have their say, and I try to drill deeper into the issues. I try to find the areas of common ground, or to highlight the real clear differences in worldview that we have. And my goal is for my listeners to show them how to win the water cooler wars, how to have these kinds of discussions with people who are friends or relatives or whatever, and you still end up friends and relatives at the end of the day, and yet you've had your say. But I can tell you that on those shows where somebody comes on and we get into a knockdown dragout, all the statistics, all the metrics that we have for measuring this show go up. You know, the activity in the chat room, the activity, you know, the number of callers calling in the program, all those things indicate that has enhanced the entertainment value of the program. That it would be we would be doing better radio right now if I was calling you an idiot or a loser or a loony or something, and you were calling me a fool and a like that. And if we were doing the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, how do we promote? And so here's the question behind that. How do we promote in America the kind of rational discourse that is necessary for a democracy to function, that was recognized by the founders as necessary for a democracy to function? You know, Jefferson's famous saying that you can't have, you know, an ignorant electorate and a democracy at the same time, never have and never will. How can we promote the kind of discourse that is actually necessary in order to have a functioning democracy without it devolving into the Jerry Springerization of, not to pick on Springer, but you know what I'm talking about,
sure,
of
absolutely.
Or the Worldwide Wrestling Federationization of political dialogue. I mean, how is that done? How can it be done in a way that it both accomplishes the necessity of broadcast, that, you know, mm-hmm. stays on the air and draws listeners, and at the same time informs people?
Absolutely. Incredibly important question, and a very difficult question to answer that we really don't have answers with. It's important to realize that we always like to make, a lot of political scientists love to throw in the quote from Aristotle that says, man by nature is a political animal.
Right.
I disagree. I think man by nature is a social animal, not necessarily political. And evidence, and we have years and years of evidence showing this, nowadays, most of mainstream America, the big center that I keep talking about, these people have jobs, these people have families, these people have social lives. And quite frankly, politics today is not pleasant. It's very, very charged. Let's say, you know, you go home, you want to go, and you have kids, and you want to go to a local PTA meeting. All it really takes is one or two very, very loud, very, very pushy people there to really charge the room up. And you might be saying, who needs this? I don't have time to go home and do this.
Yeah.
What we need is a choice. And what I mean by that is this. Many people feel that there's very little choice in politics. One of the things that we looked at, for instance, with the 2004 election was we did many simulations asking, well, do you like Bush? Do you like Kerry? The answer is people were choosing the lesser of two evils in many cases. And we threw up dummy Democratic candidates, and Democratic candidates polled incredibly well against Bush because it wasn't necessarily Bush that they liked. It's they disliked Bush and they wanted something other than Bush, but they didn't like carry. What we need is for the parties to, in particular the Democratic Party right now, because they're not on message. The Republicans have a message. It's a very, very polarizing message. And the Democrats have offered no additional choice. So there's a very, very big hole that needs to be filled of a very centrist, rational position that people can cling to and people can debate and people can talk about.
Yeah, although here
people rarely have choice.
Here we have the other problem, though. Pardon my interrupting you, but here we have the other problem. You say centrist. If you ask the majority of Americans if they want single-payer health care, they will say yes. And yet that is portrayed as an extreme lefty position. I mean, it was Dwight Eisenhower was the last president to propose that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And the problem is the Democrats allowed the Republican Party to dominate. The Republican Party has declared ownership over issues that it traditionally has not had and that it has no business being involved. And it's very a lot of the assertions it makes with, on one hand, of wanting to be, you know, very small government, let's stay out of the lives of the people. On the other hand, it wants to regulate what you do in the privacy of your own home. It's an inconsistent ideology. The problem for the Democrats with this election, and we saw this on every level from local races to congressional races to the race for the White House, was there was no message. They totally bent over and said, we're done.
Yeah.
And that was a real problem. They sat down and said, we're done. And this is
we've got about 30 seconds. We have about 30 seconds left here, Samuel Abrams. And I agree with you absolutely. But I'm just so concerned that the Democrats are going to say centrist, and they're not going to realize that it's really these liberal positions that are going to work for them. In 10 seconds, any advice?
Any advice? Sure. Our country is not going to the religious right, as it certainly appears, and I encourage every listener to read the articles in the newspaper and the magazines, listen to shows of this sort, and talk about it with people. The way to introduce new ideas is to just keep going with them.
Get informed. Get informed. Samuel Abrams, the co-author of Culture War, The Myth of a Polarized America.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up.
Having a hard time connecting with someone who cares? Try the Boys Town National Hotline at 1-800-448-3000. They'll be there to help you when you need it the most, 24 hours a day. They'll even pay for the call. Simply call 1-800-448-3000.
Boys Town National Hotline, how can I help?
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Come, writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing.
I remember when that song came out. That was I was a teenager. I was a young teenager when that thing came out, and it was a big deal. That was anyhow. Welcome back to the program. Thomas Frank raised some of the. Actually, before I get to that, I had asked Samuel Abrams, our guest in the last segment, how can you have more rational discourse on radio and television without it devolving into WWF-style slapdown stuff? And we do our share of that on this program, and frankly, I think it's fun. I think there's a place for it, and we do regularly get conservatives on here to argue with. It's getting harder and harder to get them to come on the program, oddly enough. Our goal was to have them on at least 3 days out of the week, and it's becoming a real challenge. But in any case, how do we have more rational discourse? This is, I think, the issue that that Jon Stewart raised when he was on Crossfire and said to Bogala and Carlson, you know, please stop. You're hurting America. And I personally was not all of that excited with that message. I thought that he could have done something better, but he got an enormous amount of publicity for The Daily Show by taking them on, which was its own form of WWF slapdown. So he goes on their show and he slaps them down for slapping people down, and then he gets all this publicity for it. It's you know, you got to understand the subtlety of the industry. But there is this real issue, and the way that it was dealt with prior to 1987 was with the Fairness Doctrine. There was simply this rule that said that if you're going to run a radio station, you have to have community programming. You have to have programming that serves the public good, that promotes rational dialogue, that informs people, so we can have an informed electorate. And that there was a broad consensus about that. And Ronald Reagan did away with that and paved the way for the rise of Rush Limbaugh, who has paved the way for the rise now, in my opinion, of liberal talk radio. But anyhow, Thomas Frank asked this question, and it's really at the crux of this issue. If we're not going to have the Fairness Doctrine, if we are going to have infotainment rather than real information being presented, then why is it? Or how do we handle this reality? He in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, Thomas Frank writes, "The trick never ages. The illusion never wears off. Vote to stop abortion, receive a rollback in capital gains taxes." So he's talking about why is it that people vote Republican when it harms them? Vote to make our country strong again, receive deindustrialization, the loss of factory jobs. Vote to screw those politically correct college professors, receive electricity deregulation.
vote to get government off our backs, receive conglomeration everywhere from media to meatpacking. Vote to stand tall against terrorists, receive Social Security privatization. Vote to strike a blow against elitism, receive a social order in which wealth is more concentrated than ever before in our lifetimes, in which workers have been stripped of power, and CEOs are rewarded in a manner beyond imagining. How is it? He says the trick never ages, the illusion never wears off. Well, I think that it is high time that we began speaking truth to power, not just in the political arena, but in the media arena as well, that those of us who see what's going on, and Thomas Frank's did such a good job of identifying this, and What's the Matter with Kansas, those of us who see what's going on, that there is a con job going on, that the big lie is being promulgated, who see that, start speaking out about it, and saying, as Sam Abrams did, most of America really is the radical middle. They want good health care. They want good education. They're willing to pay for it. And they want to, and they want it now. They're radicalized. 29 minutes past the hour.
You know, I was once in a vault while I was being robbed.
This December, the only thing riskier than stealing $160 million is having to pay it back.
With interest.
It just hurts.
What we do know is we need a high-paying job.
George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Andy Garcia, Don Cheadle, Bernie Mac, and Julia Roberts. Ocean's 12, a Steven Soderbergh film, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13 for language. Starts December 10th.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Security issues are one of the primary concerns for Postal Service truck drivers considering a holiday strike. Drivers for Mail Contractors of America say they may conduct a work stoppage after their company eliminated benefits. Nearly 500 drivers who operate in 8 states are involved in the dispute. The drivers are represented by the American Postal Workers Union, who say the company has slashed company contributions to health insurance, disability insurance, paid sick leave, and paid breaks. The elimination of paid breaks could cost the drivers $5,000 annually and create a security risk as they would no longer be required to watch their trucks. Mail Contractors of America hauls nearly 10% of the U.S. mail.
New York State's Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory in their 6-year-long campaign to raise New York State's minimum wage. New York has become the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage above the federal $5.15 per hour. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007, but New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed that measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit. According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will, directly or indirectly, get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Reversing a lower court decision, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the city of Philadelphia acted within its power by extending benefits to same-sex life partners of employees. The benefits were awarded in 1998, but in 2002, the Commonwealth Court ruled the city had overstepped its authority. The state Supreme Court ruling says that while there are facial similarities between marriage and life partnership, we simply do not agree that they are sufficient to establish that the city has legislated in the area of marriage. William Devlin, a conservative activist, says he plans to appeal the court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of the decision, Devlin says, I guess what they're saying is that the family is anybody who has appeared on Jerry Springer. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent article in the Cleveland Plains Dealer traced the history of one job after a Sunbeam Corporation closed a plant in Cleveland. At the plant, one worker who lost her job made $9 per hour. The job then went to Matamoros, Mexico, where workers averaged $2.36 per hour. That still wasn't a good enough saving on labor. Eventually, that factory closed and shifted its production to China, where the workers are paid on average only 47 cents per hour.
You've been listening to Win.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See how they explain the inexplicable. Watch them all debate the undebatable.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. This is the story that you haven't heard from the cons who are ranting and raving about how Kofi Annan should leave the UN because his son might or might not have been involved in some corrupt way in the oil for food program in Iraq. This story just out. Federal investigators are focusing on four, this by the way from the Wall Street Journal, are focusing on four American oil companies and three U.S. citizens who allegedly received vouchers for oil from Saddam Hussein as he sought to flout United Nations sanctions. The U.S. companies, including ExxonMobil Corp, Chevron Texaco Corp, and El Paso Corp, or their predecessors, and individuals were identified in the Central Intelligence Agency's 1,000-page report on the Hussein regime's campaign, though their names were redacted. That's a fancy word for blacked out from the publicly released version. So there you have it. If Kofi Annan has to leave the UN, then Exxon, Chevron, and El Paso Corp have to leave the United States, right? The Dolfer report, and then you got the Dolfer report, lists hundreds of foreign companies and individuals who allegedly received Iraqi oil vouchers, but it doesn't list the U.S. companies and citizens. But they were there. They were sure enough there. And some of them are pretty well wired in to Mr. George W. Bush and his campaign. Speaking of well wired in, the New York Times reports when federal drug officials suspected in 1992, this is from an article by Gardner Harris, titled "At FDA, Strong Drug Ties and Less Monitoring." When federal drug officials suspected in 1992 that a popular allergy pill might cause heart problems, they turned to their own scientists. Now, keep in mind, this was just 12 years ago. Just 12 years ago. But the whole conservative economic notion, this whole belief that started with the Reagan administration, that all things government are bad and all things corporate are good, has taken over even the FDA. And I'm not here to tell you that all things government are good and all things corporate are bad either. The truth is in the middle, as is so often the case. There are some things that government does very well. They do very efficiently. We handle Social Security at less than 1% of overhead costs. You hand it over to private corporations, you're going to see your overhead costs go up to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7%. We handle Medicare. We handle private. We handle health insurance at less than 1%. Less than 2% overhead cost. Private corporations, healthcare corporations, anywhere from 12 to 35% of all the money paid into private corporations for health insurance sticks to their fingers instead of making its way to your doctor or your hospital. There are some things the government does better, does more efficiently than private industry. On the other hand, there are a lot of things that private industry does better and more efficiently than government. I would much rather have my shoes made by a private company than by government. Thank you very much. The clothes I'm wearing, the house I'm living in, the phone I'm using, I mean, you name it. Consumer goods. All, goes on and on. I mean, I'm all in favor. I'm all in favor of private corporations making things for the government, for the military. I don't think that the government should be manufacturing rifles or tanks, for example. I also don't think that it should be legal for somebody to leave a job in the government, for example, as a Pentagon procurement officer, and then take a job with the company that they've been buying those tanks from. But that's another issue. Well, really, it's not. Really, it's not, because that's what this gets back to, is that in the pressure started building in 1980 when Ronald Reagan ran
as the outsider against government. The overt message of the Reagan campaign was government is bad and that Reagan is going to come in as the outsider and he's going to clean it up. Ignoring the fact that he'd been the governor of the largest state in the union, you know, he'd been in inside government. Ignoring the fact that he ran for re-election on the same campaign, essentially ran against himself, and won. Still scratching my head over that one. Well, we all know, actually, what happened. He borrowed $1 trillion from you and me. We are paying over $150, $160 billion in taxes this year to pay interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up in 91, 92, 93, I'm sorry, 81, 82, 83, so that when it came time for him to run for re-election in 84, he could have what looked like prosperity. Same thing George W. Bush is doing. It's an old trick that the cons have. But the central focus of Reagan's ideology was government is bad, make government smaller, have government do less and fewer. Now, ironically, government actually shrank in terms of the number of employees and the number of dollars going through it in real terms during the Clinton administration and grew during the Reagan and Bush II administrations at rates faster than it has ever grown in the history of the United States, both in terms of percentages and absolute numbers when you exclude the two times that we were involved in world wars or the Civil War, which I think are it's reasonable to exclude those as anomalies because the Reagan and Bush administrations were also not wartime administrations. Some would argue that George W. is in a war. I would say, no, we've got some terrorists we're fighting. But that's a whole... Yeah, we've got a war in Iraq, but we didn't need it. But anyhow, the whole point is that Reagan ran this campaign saying government is bad. We need to cut back on government, give more to private industry. So what has happened, and that has carried through. Even Bill Clinton signed on for this. The new Democrats, Tony Blair, new Labor. It's all Republican light. And so what they were saying is, the FDA, it's supposed to keep our drugs safe, but let's just turn it over to the companies. In 1992, there was a popular allergy pill on the market. The FDA started to suspect it was causing heart attacks. They turned it over to their own scientists, found, sure enough, there's a problem with this drug, and they pulled it off the market. Just like that. That's what the FDA is supposed to do. That was 1992. 8 years later, that, by the way, was 4 years ago, year 2000, 8 years later, similar worries surrounded the arthritis pill Vioxx. No, you can't blame this on George W. Bush. This happened during Clinton. Okay, got it. I agree with you. This is not about partisan politics. This is about ideology. This is about, are we going to have the commons? Are we going to have a government that does what we want? If we want to have safe drugs, if we want to have safe food, are we going to say, okay, we want that. We will pay taxes for it. We want the government to do it. Or are we going to have a bunch of extremist ideologues in government say, well, sounds good and we'll talk like that's the case, but really we're going to let our buddies in industry do this because when we leave our jobs, we can make $1 million a year as lobbyists for them. You think I'm exaggerating? Look at Billy Towson. Anyhow, here from the New York Times, this article, 8 years later, we're back in 1992, FDA, allergy drug, dangerous, warning signal. They looked to their own scientists. They said, their own scientists said, sure enough, there's a problem with this thing. Pull it off the market. Boom, off it goes. That was 1992. 8 years later, similar worries surrounded the arthritis pill Vioxx. But by then, writes Gardner Harris in the New York Times, but by then the Food and Drug Administration had shifted gears, slashing its laboratories and network of independent drug safety experts in favor of hiring more people to approve drugs. Changes that arose under an unusual agreement that has left the agency increasingly reliant on and bound by drug company money. Discovering Vioxx's dangers would take 4 more years. 100,000 people with strokes or heart attacks estimated. Estimated over 20,000 people dead. 20,000 people dead. That's what? 7 times, roughly, the number of people who died in the World Trade Center with a terrorist attack? More than 6 times, certainly. And we're not declaring war on this as a problem? 20,000 Americans dead? No, we're not. We're saying, well, you know, it's just the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, you know, it's... they've got enough money to advertise that the media doesn't really want to take them on. The New York Times reporting this. I doubt you're going to see much of this on network news, though, because the network news organizations are all taking hundreds of millions in aggregate from the pharmaceutical industry. The article continues, under a 1992 agreement, the industry promised to give the agency millions. The pharmaceutical industry promised to give the Food and Drug Administration millions, as in millions of dollars. In the 2000 fiscal year, $200 million. But only if the agency spent a specified level of money on new drug approvals. So we cut out money for making sure the drugs are safe, give tax cuts to the rich, and how are we going to fund the FDA? We're going to go to the pharmaceutical companies and say, please give us $200 million. And they say, okay, we'll do that, but only if you do what we say. The New York Times continues, as congressional support sank since then, the agency has cut everything else but new drug reviews. In the past 11 years, spending on the reviews has increased to more than four-fifths of the budget of the agency's drug center from about half. Among the priorities that took the worst hit was ensuring the safety of the drugs that patients are already taking. Half, they point out, the New York Times, half of the budget for the Food and Drug Administration's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, the principal office that oversees drug reviews and safeties, will come from the drug industry. Up from how much in 1992? Zero! 31% in 1998, but these millions come with strings, notes the New York Times. Since the 1992 agreement, agency officials have eliminated half of the scientists in the drug center's laboratories and starved them of new equipment. They point out the agency has even raided furniture and travel budgets. They shut down laboratories. And this, therefore, the reason why Dr. David J. Graham, the guy who has now been shut up and moved out of the way, testified before Congress last week, or a couple weeks ago, that the agreement had, quote, made a bad situation worse. And he said, and if this problem isn't fixed, future Vioxx-like catastrophes are inevitable. Inevitable. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts on this or any other issue today, 14 minutes before the hour. Diane in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to comment on something you said yesterday, because I can't always comment, I can't always call when you say something, but it always makes me think.
Okay.
Yesterday, I think it was yesterday or the day before, you were talking about how you took your son to school, took him out of regular school and into a better school, a non-Horace Mann school, and he thrived.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I sort of did a similar thing when my kids were young. I took them out of school because I determined that schools were really harmful to young people. And they thrived, and they were doing great. And I met the entire, there was this entire web of homeschooling community of people who were like-minded and doing the same thing. And I remember being in a homeschool meeting of homeschool parents and looking around and realizing, this was, 20 years ago, that the right wing was going to take over because all of the homeschool movement was right wing and me.
Well, here's the interesting change that's happened, Diane. In the 1970s, as I recall, and I wrote about this in my last book on ADHD, The Edison Gene. In the 1970s, roughly 90% of homeschool children were being homeschooled because of religious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2000, more than 60% of homeschooled children were being homeschooled because their parents felt it was a better academic option than public or private schools. So it's completely changed.
Oh, well, that's good. So hopefully the right wing's takeover was only temporary, now that we'll get more non-programmed kids that are not necessarily right wing into the mix.
Well, and it's not even so much right-wing as in political. It's the conservative religious. And what has happened is that the conservative religious, number one, have started creating their own private schools more and more, just like the Catholics did long ago. And those still, those remnants are still around. And number two, and perhaps most alarming, is that they are now trying to take control of the public school systems.
Right. Well, that'll mean that they'll be at a disadvantage because their kids will stop being homeschooled and start being schooled.
And but see, the reality is a lot of people can't afford to homeschool. I mean, we were able to put Justin in a private school because at the time, I ran an advertising agency. I was making good money, and we could afford to do that. Most Americans, it's a real challenge. They don't, they have to. They that's not an option. I think probably for the majority.
It depends on your priority.
Yeah, certainly it does. It does. But if you've got a situation where you've got both parents working, as with our youngest when we were homeschooling her, it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. So we have to have, in my opinion, Diane, we have to have a good public education system. We just have to fix it. Diane, thanks for the call. We got to move along. Good to hear from you, though. Thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a WIN feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. After a six-year-long campaign, the Working Families Party, labor and religious organizations finally scored a victory as New York became the 16th state to raise its state minimum wage. Alex Navarro is communications director for the Working Families Party of New York.
The legislation that will go into effect on January 1st will increase the minimum wage in New York State from $5.15, the current federal level, to initially $6 on January 1st, 2005, then to $6.75 January 1st, 2006, and finally to $7.15 on January 1st, 2007.
In July, both houses of the state legislature voted to increase the state's minimum wage to $7.15 by January 2007. New York Republican Governor George Pataki promptly vetoed the measure, saying it would hurt business owners. But in August, the state assembly voted to override the veto, and yesterday the state Senate followed suit.
The state Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, voted overwhelmingly to override Governor Pataki's veto, voting 51-7 to actually override a veto by a governor from their own party. It was quite remarkable, and it's really a demonstration of how important this issue was to so many voters across the state.
According to supporters of the legislation, an estimated 1.2 million New Yorkers will directly or indirectly get a raise during the three-part phase-in period.
Increasing the minimum wage is actually good for New York State's economy and certainly good for New York State's workers. It puts money in the pockets of people who will spend it and spend it locally. It's a much more effective economic stimulus mechanism than giving tax cuts to the affluent who go and spend that money out of state. This is good for New York State's economy, it's good for New York State businesses, and it's good for New York State's workers.
With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
The economy is not feeling too good. It's Americans, the conservative economics and conservative environmental policies, so-called conservative, are really raising some problems here. George Bush's new administration, writes Jeffrey Lean in The Independent. This is when we have to rely on the mainstream media in Britain for reporting on what's happening in the United States. You know that there's something wrong. George Bush's new administration, writes Jeffrey Lean, and its supporters controlling Congress are setting out to dismantle three decades of U.S. environmental protection. In a little over a month since his reelection, they have announced that they will comprehensively rewrite three of the country's most important environmental laws. They will open up vast new areas for oil and gas drilling and reshape the official Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. They said that the election gave them a mandate for the measures, which ironically will overturn a legislative system originally established by the Republican presidents Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon, and mostly by Nixon. Now, probably we should add the caveat that Nixon presided over the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he even tried to take credit for it. But it was the Democrats in the House and the Senate who controlled the House and Senate who brought that into being in 1972, not Richard Nixon. But nonetheless, you know, Richard Nixon is remembered as the guy who created the EPA because he signed the legislation. As we go back to the story, even though Mr. Bush went out of his way to avoid emphasizing his environmental plans during his campaign. Yes, he has a mandate, but he never discussed the environment. Weren't you amazed that in not one of the three debates was the environment even brought up? That just boggled my mind. Mike Leavitt, the Bush-appointed head of the EPA, said, "The election was a validation of the philosophy and the agenda of the Bush administration of taking apart these environmental rules. Right. He points out that over a third of the agency's staff will become eligible for president over the president's retirement over the president's 4-year term, enabling him to fill it with people lenient to polluters. This from the Economist. Far more radical measures are also underway. Joe Barton, the Texas Republican chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, who is to help push through the energy bill, has also announced a comprehensive review of the Clean Air Act, one of the world's most successful environmental laws. Over the last 2 years, for the first time in 30 years, we have seen the air and water of the United States actually get dirtier. Plan on more. Unless you get politically active, contact your local elected representatives, your state elected representatives, and say, no, we would like to have a clean environment. Thank you very much. We don't want our kids dying from cancer. Thanks to Louise for producing our program, to Ira for engineering it, to Shelby for streaming us around the planet, to the folks in our chat room for showing up, and to you for listening. It is much appreciated. See you here tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage